Okay, we are recording. This is Jen Brown, and it is March 13th, 2022. I'm here with Captain David Rousey to do an oral history interview and talk about his work with Baffin Bay and Baffin Bay water quality samples. So, for the record, do I have your permission to record?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So this is an oral history, and always we like to start with, can you tell me more about your background and early life?
Early life, I was born in Faraday, Louisiana, and raised by a bunch of fishermen. I was blessed to both sides of my family. Had a great background in sport fishing. My mother divorced, and my sister, my mother, and I moved to Natchez, Mississippi, and lived there till I was 12 years old. And mother remarried, and I landed in Hunt, Texas, which is the headwaters of the Guadalupe River, you know, about, 75, 80 miles northwest of San Antonio. And always fished all my childhood. You know, it was always my number one hobby, my favorite thing ever to do. And I got a taste of salt water when I was in high school. And it just kind of changed my life. And I went from being a freshwater bass fisherman to falling hard into the saltwater scene. And I became a real estate appraiser when I was about 21 years old. And I learned the trade in San Antonio while I was going to school up there. And I became state certified as a real estate appraiser really young. And I was spending all my free time on the highway driving from San Antonio to here, you know, to have 3-day weekends so I could fish. You know, I did that for years, for, you know, every week or 3 weekends out of every month I was down here fishing. And once I became state certified, I could work anywhere in the state. And as a young man, and, you know, not really understanding responsibilities and everything, I just pulled the plug in San Antonio and moved down here on a whim so I could fish more. And anyway, so appraising allowed me a lot of free time. I could set up schedules around weather. And, you know, if it was going to be a really gorgeous morning in 2 days, I could set up appointments for the afternoon to do my money job. And, you know, I could fish for 3 or 4 hours, come in, shower up, go do my work, come back to my home office, write appraisals at night. And I just did that for years and years and years.
What got you hooked on saltwater fishing?
Well, I am known as a trout guy. Specifically, I'm known as a, you know, a guy that loves to chase big trophy trout. And, that's where my clientele generally hires me. I get some clientele that hires me, you know, just to learn how to fish lures and what have you. But saltwater fishing, you know, what got me hooked was actually, fighting a redfish for the first time. You know, it's just a bulldog compared to a canary. You know, the difference between a trout and a redfish as far as the battle goes. You know, they're very strong, drag tugging, can't turn them. And I'd never felt a fish fight like that. And I just thought that was the coolest thing in the world. Being very new and green at the deal, it took me some time to realize that trout were very similar to the past that I was always pursuing as a young man. In other words, they're just great predators. They, you know, they basically eat the same kind of artificial lures. So a lot of things that were in freshwater transferred right over into saltwater. And I realized, or didn't realize, but it, you know, records are, you know, I don't want to go down that road, but trout was just more similar to bass fishing, more elusive of a fish. You know, just a big trout is really a great accomplishment. You know, redfish are plentiful. They're all kind of the same size. They're fun as heck to fight. But the large trout become loners. And, you know, to pursue them and to get them to commit to an artificial lure after standing hours in the mud and wet and for day after day after day, it's just really rewarding to, you know, land them. So I just became addicted to it. And, but that's what first got me into the salt water and how it just, you know, mushroomed from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So can you talk more about how you shifted from going to real estate appraisal to being a fishing guide?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. I loved appraising. It was a great career. And as much as I loved fishing, I never had any desire in the world to be a fishing guide. I mean, that was just, that was so far, it wasn't even a consideration. And what happened is in the, like about 1995, they started using croaker as a bait fish down here. And croaker are so effective that, I mean, you know, they're in the right hands, they're more effective than a gill net that, you know, a commercial fisherman that is outlawed now in Texas. And so I'd already fallen in love with these big giant trout, of which Baffin has a lot of them, or did have a lot of them. And so in 95 it started, and in about 2000 we had about 30 guides in the whole Coastal Bend that were considered full-time guides, and Coastal Bend being Corpus Christi to Rockport. And by 2005 we had over 300 guides because of croaker, and it was so easy and so effective. It was an easy way to make a buck off of a state resource. You know, you didn't really have to put much in the pot and you could make good money being a guide. And a lot of people saw that. And today's 2022, and I just heard that there are over 700 registered guides now in the Coastal Bend. So it went from, you know, around 30 in 95 to 2000, 30 guides, to now we're in the 700 range. And watching these big boxes of fish come in day after day with all these huge giant dead fish, you know, it just really started affecting me in the head, you know. And I was just, you know, I was too attached to these fish, you know. And a friend of mine was fishing with a guide one day, and I asked him, I was like, he's like, man, we had the most incredible day. And I'm like, yeah, but there's no sport in that, you know. Where's the honor? And he said, well, I don't know how to do what you do. Nobody will teach me how to lure fish. And I was like, that's the only thing holding you back from, you know, doing the way I do it? And he's like, yeah. So I got the thought in my head somewhere along the way that if I can teach people how to lure fish and take the more conservation route and join the sport versus a pitcher at the end of the day with a box of dead fish, you know, and I'll go back and I say, I tell people all the time, I started guiding out of spite. So I said, if I can convert one croaker fisherman over to teaching to lure fish and take a conservation mindset, you know, it's a win. So I decided to do that, and I got my guide's license, and you know, I could only guide on the weekend. And a little bit of backstory, I used to fish a lot of big trout tournaments, and I was blessed to win quite a few. So I had some pretty good name recognition out there already as a guy that catches big fish. So that directly just went into the guiding thing. And you know, once my name got thrown out there, the people started coming. I had way more business than I could even begin to handle. And I was, you know, and something happened in the real estate market in around 2010, and a lot of changes were made to the appraisal industry. And you know, I wouldn't say I was burnt out, but I was kind of on the edge of it. And you know, the phone's just ringing for charters, and I just on a whim said a prayer, said, all right, God, you know, if we're going to get into this deal, you know, you better back me up. And my wife and I had not been married very long. And I told her I was going to quit appraising and guide full time. And, you know, she thought I was crazy. But anyway, I've been very blessed. Haven't skipped a beat. My clientele rarely keeps a fish, you know, occasional redfish or drum, you know, one for a fresh meal. Since the freeze, we've released every single trout. We've had a few DOAs that come in, got caught in a gill or something, and so of course we've cleaned them, not so they wouldn't be wasted, but you know, the younger generation is really up to speed and all in on the catch and release thing. Generation probably older than myself, I guess, you know, but yeah, they're a little bit older. There's an older way of thinking, you know, that there's plenty of fish in the bay, but at one time there probably were, but there's not anymore when some of these guys now that are in their late 70s, 80s, when they were really young men, there were. You couldn't hurt them with a rod and reel, but there wasn't that many people participating in it. You know, when they changed the harvest regulations in 1983, they changed it. All your bag limit was 10 trout and 3 reds. And that was based on 250,000 saltwater stamps sold at the time. So we recently went to 5 fish just prior to the freeze of 2021. And at that time, there's, I think, 1.5 million saltwater stamps sold. So, you know, we went from 250,000 to 1.5 million. And I'm probably light on that number. And we still had the same limits. So you can imagine how many fish were coming out of the bay. And guys like myself that are on the water every day, we can see it. We can tell by rod and reel. You know, we are just not catching the fish where we should, when we should. We're just not catching the numbers. And certainly not the trophies. You know, you take out the middle of the gene pool, and they don't have a chance to get big. So the trophies really took a big hit. So I've just been on a pulpit for, you know, I started guiding in 2006 part-time, and I've just used it as a pulpit to preach conservation and, you know, do what's right for the bay. You know, I love to eat fish as much as anybody, but just take what you need. I mean, just because the state says this is the law and you could take that many, it doesn't mean it's right. You know, I have all the respect in the world for parks and wildlife, and, I feel like I've got a better handle on things out here than what they actually see in their nets when they do their spring net surveys. You know, talking to people and seeing what comes in the boxes, you know, people saying they had a good day, and a good day is defined differently now than it was 15 years ago. I mean, a good day now, 15 years ago, was a horrible day. But a lot of people are just into it. They've only been fishing for 5 or 7, 10 years. They don't know what the good days were. They don't know what the bay's capable of producing. But, you know, I'm 52 years old now, and guiding should be getting easier for me every year with the knowledge I have out here. And it's harder every year, you know, because there's truly less fish to catch. Mm-hmm. So, but that whole thing, the whole trout kill was the reason I became a guide. It certainly wasn't for the money. I can promise you that. I made a lot more money appraising real estate.
Really? So what kind of lessons do you try to teach your clients?
I try to teach them a lot of things, but conservation is the number one. You know, if you say I've got a 40-year-old on the boat and he's got 2 sons that are 10 and 12 years old. I mean, you know, if you want them to enjoy this fishery, you know, you got to be proactive now. You got to teach them that it's not right to kill everything out here. If you ever want to catch a trophy fish, just like the analogy I just told you, you just, if you take out the middle of the middle mature fish, the 20 to 25 inch fish, if you're killing those, you're never going to grow 27 to 32 inch fish. I mean, it's just simple. You know, I'm real big on selling the sport of fishing. Not, you know, a lot of people, and, you know, their idea of a good day is catch as many as you can, as fast as you can, and get back to the dock. And people are paying guides to go out and do that. But I hear those same people go, well, God, we were only out for 2 hours. You know, got charged $900. You know, that's not what it should be about. It should be out there with your family, with your friends, making memories. And, you know, even if the fishing's slow, enjoy seeing the dolphins, the birds, and, you know, me explaining why a fish should be there versus there. And, you know, just teaching them the tools of the trade and how to be successful out here, but be good stewards of the bay. I mean, that's just the bottom line for me. Just respect the bay. And, you know, we have And my whole goal is to get the fishery back to the trophy side, and we've got potential for that now. Since the freeze, you know, this week, Wednesday, the state of Texas Parks and Wildlife, the laws changed from 5. Right now, the limit is 5 fish what is the limit? 5 fish. I think the minimum is 15 inches right now. And there's no upper end limit. You can only have one a day over 25 inches. But as of this Wednesday, March the 16th, for the next 2 years, the limit's going to be 17 to 23, no fish over 23, and the bag limit of 3 fish because of the freeze. Now, if everybody gets on the board and releases what they catch, I mean, we actually, the freeze can actually have a positive effect on us, I think. It could almost be a blessing if everybody gets on board and starts releasing their fish. In 2 years, them changing the regs to that is going to give us like a 26 or 27% increase in spawn. And so that's going to be huge for us. And in 2 years, releasing all these fish that are now illegal to keep over 23 inches, those fish are going to have an opportunity to get really big again. And that's what people come to this area for. It's what it's known for. The state records are set here. I mean, these are some of the biggest trout, speckled trout in the world. And they come to this destination to catch those big fish. And so, you know, that's just, I guess, my purpose or what I try to sell when I'm standing on my, quote, pulpit, you know, is just conservation and, you know, look to the future. You know, don't live in the moment. Don't be selfish. Take some to eat, but just take what you need fresh and, you know, let the rest go, you know, with to keep a fish as a trophy to get a skin mount. I mean, that's not necessary anymore. You have fiberglass replicas that look even better. You know, a picture on the water holding a beautiful trout is a lot better than you standing next to an ice chest with a bunch of dead trout with gray eyes, you know. It's just, you know, I just try to sell that and just, you know, the conservation side of it.
Yeah. So let's talk about Baffin Bay. What do you think makes Baffin Bay so special?
Well, that's a great question. Baffin is very special because Baffin, kind of like a lake, is essentially landlocked. You know, it's, and the closest big passes north and south are Port Mansfield and Port Aransas. And they're roughly 45 miles north of Baffin and roughly 45 miles south of Baffin. So Baffin doesn't have a lot of water exchange, so it's really salty, you know, 2 to 3 times saltier than some of the other bays. So it's considered a hypersaline bay. And the trout that have been there for, you know, however many thousands of years, you know, they don't migrate back and forth like a lot of other trout do. They just stay there and get big and big and big. So there's this genetic trout back there that has just superior genetics to other trout up and down the coast. And so that's what makes it special as far as the trophy fishing goes. You know, Baffin has the famous rock formations that are fossilized worm matter, should I call them? And it only occurs in two bays in the world, I believe, and both of them are hypersaline bays. Baffin Bay and a bay in Australia is the only place they've, and I may be wrong, but I think I'm 99% right. The only two bays that have these rock formations, and which makes the bay very hard to navigate. If you don't know what you're doing, you can tear your boats up and hurt yourself. So that makes it really special. And the other thing that's really cool about Baffin versus other saltwater destinations is surrounded to the east by Padre Island National Seashore, undeveloped. North side of the bay is the King Ranch, no development. South side of the bay is Kennedy Ranch, no development. So you go down there and it's like stepping back in time. You don't see houses. Well, you see some on Spoil Islands, fishermen cabins, but you don't see development or anything like that. So it's just a really untouched, natural place, you know, that's really unique and different than most.
Mm-hmm. What has been your most memorable experience fishing Baffin Bay?
Oh, gosh. Impossible to answer. Okay. Impossible question, but I don't know. You know, there's all kinds of things. You know, I was just making a wade this past week and we were walking towards a rock pile my clients don't know it's there, but there's a little pole sticking up and I recognize it. And I said, hey, there's a rock pile right there. And I said, be careful to go around it because you'll trip and get cut up. And they're like, how do you know that rock pile? I'm like, yeah. I said, as a matter of fact, the first trout I ever caught over 7 pounds on a topwater lure was off of that rock pile, you know. So that those kind of things are special memories. The first time I ever won a big trout tournament was in Baffin. The first time that I ever put a client on a 10-pound trout, which is like, you know, a huge deal. I mean, it's like crazy big deal. You know, that was in Baffin. You know, I've got a cabin on one of the spoil islands in Baffin. So, you know, the water's up my back porch and my front porch, and I've spent countless nights down there watching sunrises and sunsets and, you know, watching dolphins come up to the end of the pier when you pull your boat up wanting something to eat, and shrimp migrating through and under the lights at night and skipping all over the water. And there's a big pelican migration that happens right after sunset that's just unbelievable, that most people never get to witness unless they've been down there. And and I've got just tons of good memories. Got some memories that aren't so good, like sinking boats and things like that. And, you know, those kind of things are great memories now. Everybody's safe, but at the time they weren't the making of a great memory. I think the ultimate thing, because I started doing it so young and being a wade fisherman, and that is how I fish. I mean, you saw my boat out there. I got this big, gorgeous, heavy-duty boat, but we really just use it as an Uber or a taxi transport. You know, we get to where we're going, we have on our waders, we get in the water, and we fish. And so a lot of my great memories are just, that's all I ever did was I would park my boat and I'd walk all day, and it's literally how I learned the bay. You know, it was like I had eyeballs on my feet. You know, and I just remember these things. Then the development of GPSs, you know, you can start plugging things in. So I know the bay very uniquely. You know, I would almost call it an intimate relationship. You know, it's I fished every nook and cranny of it, and you know, I've walked all of it, you know, and that's how I know it. And those things have made it very special to me, that whole learning process. I've been asked, wouldn't you want to live somewhere else and trout fish over in Florida or something? I'm like, no way, man. I was like, you know, it's taken me 30-something years to learn all this. I don't have the time or the energy to go learn things as well as I know this. This is like knowing your best friend, you know. You know, knowing what's going to come out of their mouth. You know what she's going to give you. Every little wind that comes through, you know, it's like, all right, we need to get out of here because it's fixing to get real ugly. You know, just knowing every little nuance of the bay. And I've just learned those over the years, and going through that learning process has made it all very special to me.
Yeah, that's cool. So I hear you and John Sutton have a funny story about a fishing spot.
John Sutton is a great, and hopefully he won't get offended when I say it, he's a great old-timer fisherman. You know, he's one of the guys you look up to. John's one of the few guys in the world that has actually landed a 13-pound trout, which is like, you know, 10 is just unheard of. John's actually landed a 13. And I honestly, I don't know the story you're exactly referring to. But John has got a little special fishing hole that fishes here on the King Ranch shoreline, and I didn't know John at the time, but it's a place I like to fish too. And I was always like, who is this guy in my spot, you know? And eventually I got to know John and realized who it was. And I don't know if that's the story or not, but that's kind of essentially how John and I started talking. Saw him at the boat ramp one day, and I'm like, man, you're always over there. And he's like, well, it's like my favorite place, short, close trip. And I said, I get it. There's some great trout in there at times. But John's a neat guy, and a lot of respect for him. He's done some things in Baffin that most anglers would only dream of.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk about the changes you've noticed to Baffin Bay over time?
The big changes that I've seen that come and go, and I know we're going to get into that, has been the brown tide. That's one of the major changes. The introduction as croaker as a bait fish was, you know, a huge change to baffin and how it changed the dynamic of kill fishing and sport fishing. Just really kind of drove a wedge between fishermen, and you know, for most of the sports is what I mean. You got your lure guys on one side, you got your bait guys on the other. So there's kind of this croaker kind of put a wedge, you know, in between them. Because of that, I'm not saying all, but, you know, the mindset of that type of fisherman, the croaker fisherman, is to get your fish in the box and, you know, be done with it. And, that's opposite of what I do, which is, you know, catch and release. And that's had a real detrimental effect on the numbers of fish, especially, like I said a while ago, the big trophy fish, because they kill so many of the breeder fish, the 20 to 25s that become the trophies. So we've seen that trophy fish. We've watched the trophy fish take a big decline over the last 10 years. And we know what it's attributable to. And I don't think people will argue the point, but that is the truth of the matter. So brown tide, croaker fishing, and one of the side effects of brown tide is when it comes in, there's not enough sunlight penetration to get to the bay bottom. So in the 1 to 4 foot of water where the grass grows, when you don't get the sunlight penetration, we lose a lot of grass in the process. And you don't have all those little sanctuaries for the bait fish and those sorts of things. So that's why water quality was always a really big concern down here when the first brown tide blooms popped up. You know, I mean, I haven't read up on this in a while, but the first brown tides occurred in the late 80s when they first popped up. And, you know, it lasted for years and years and years. And it lasted into the 90s. And that's really part of the reason the croaker started was you know, they make so much noise when you hook them and shake them, that, you know, it gives the trout that are there something to come to. They can't see them in this water. So it actually gives them a reason to come over to it, check it out, and eat it. That's what made them very vulnerable to be caught. And, but those are the major changes. One more though, the amount of pressure that, oh my God, the amount of people on the water now is unbelievable. And that goes back to that 1.5 million saltwater stamps sold. Technology, fast boats, more people. I mean, you know, used to go to Baffin was an hour plus drive down there in the smaller boats that we had. Now we got boats that go 70 to 90 miles an hour and you can be down there in a matter of minutes. You know, something that was remote and really special and, you know, just, you know, that it was an adventure to go to Baffin is now easily done because of all the new technology, and there's a lot of people that have it. So all the fishing areas, you know, the boat lanes and everything's just a lot more crowded now. So,
you know, you talk about you're an artificial lure fisherman. Can you talk about, has your tackle changed over time? Has your approach changed over time? Types of lures, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like everything else, you know, technology and everything, there's always improvements and modifications and things. And, you know, when there were a lot of fish in the bay, you could just go out there with just about any kind of little piece of plastic on a jig head and catch a fish. And the lure manufacturers have figured out that, like I said very early on, that trout and bass fishing are so much alike. You know, they've taken a lot of their lures and repackaged them as saltwater because they're, you know, they're so effective. And I've got, I mean, they're kind of behind you, but I've got tons of them hanging on the wall and on the racks of, you know, things that have progressed over time. And, you know, a trout can be caught on soft plastics, hard spoons, you know, subsurface plugs, topwater lures, a popping cork with a jig and plastic under it. You know, those are all different lure ways to catch fish. And, you know, every year they make some kind of a modification to make this lure or any of these lures look more and more natural in the water. So, you know, versus when the saltwater lures first started, I mean, they have just it's amazing how much it's grown and the way the industry is taking it. And you know, and I always tell people a new lure does most of its catching at the counter. Okay, it's catching the fishermen because it's pretty, it's shiny, and you know, a lot of them don't even work. You know, they're just, you know, that somebody will do something gimmicky and advertise the hell out of it on Facebook or Instagram, and you know, it's a new hot thing. But I've just learned over time, a lot of the old lures that or a lot of the new lures that are now are just little modifications on some of the lures that were built in the, let's say really the lures really started getting a overhaul in the 90s and the 2000s and the teens. You know, that's where a huge transition took, and you know, they started coming out with all these new designs and everything. And but and I'm guilty of buying all of them. I mean, this place is a museum to lures, but I'm at the point now that I can go out with just a handful of confidence lures. Some of them are old, some of them are kind of new. And you know, the most productive is still the little soft plastic on a jig head. So these lures, you know, they keep progressing and getting changed and everything, but it all comes down to, can you make a lure look like a wounded fish? And it doesn't matter how old the lure is. If you can pull that off, you can catch a trout. So, you know, but the lures are, you know, like I said, they do most of the catching at the cash register.
Yeah. Nice. Well, let's talk about your work on the Baffin Bay monitoring project. So can you tell me how that all started?
I'm involved with quite a few groups, and you know, a lot of people, some of them retired, that are just, some of them live on Baffin. And I believe Scott Murray was the first one that brought this to my attention, that they were going to start this program. And when he told me what they were going to do, you know, we were in the midst of a brown tide. And, you know, I was just disgusted with the bay because this thing keeps reoccurring. You know, we'll get a year or two of beautiful water, then it comes back, and it's just horrible. And I was like, look, I don't know what y'all need or what, but I'm in as a volunteer. I said, I'll volunteer my time, you know, my boat, I'll pay for the gas, you know, just to get y'all whoever needs to be where, you know. And so it really just started off like that, just a simple conversation. And it was a subject close to my heart. So, you know, I wanted to be involved in it. And so I just started doing it and just started running the boat for them and just doing sometimes without the scientists, doing other field samples where I would see an occurrence where the water was really pretty, you know, and it looked normal, but you know, there was something on the shoreline that was making it real brown and ugly. Something was occurring. In those spots, I would GPS them, take water samples, get them to Mike's group, you know, that sort of thing. So just whatever I could do to keep them informed and keep the information line open, and anything they needed, you know, that I was willing to do for them, I was, you know, so I just kind of stayed on that level.
Can you describe what the brown tide looked like in those years?
Yeah, a really super dark tea, you know, just a really strong tea. Almost looks like some brackish waters I've seen in Florida, you know. But there's, in their cases, it's different because they have trees dropping leaves and stuff in. And you're getting dyes off the leaves that change theirs. And so there's a big difference there. We don't have those types of trees to drop foliage in the water to do that. And, but it's so it looks like a dark tea. And if the wind blows, it gets mixed up with the muddy water. And I mean, the visibility in it is like a half an inch, if that, you know. So it's, and then, like I mentioned earlier, the sunlight doesn't get a chance to make it to the grass. The grass dies off. You lose all those sanctuaries for the shrimp, the bait fish, all that. So it has a really detrimental effect on the fishery. And, you know, this is not scientific by any means. This is just me talking to what I experienced with a rod and reel. First of all, you know you're limited using lures because they've got to see or feel the vibration off the lure. And so fishing would regress. You know, fishing just wouldn't be as good. And then you would think, fishing is so bad. Have these fish left the system and gone out to the mouth of the bay, or tried to go south through the land cut to find cleaner water? And so you had that going on. You're playing mind games. Where are these fish? You know, you can't tell anything. There's no life in the bay. There's no mullet on the surface, or no shrimp flipping or anything. So you have the feeling everything's gone. So another example of how the brown tide is. So every year from Port Mansfield north to Baffin through what we call the land cut, which is just a, dredge through the flats for barges to go through, the brown tide has creeped into the land cut. So every year coming from Mansfield, we've always had what we call the spring tide and the trout run. And, there's a certain amount of trout that are migratory, and they come up through the south, infiltrate Baffin, do their thing, and some of them stay, some of them leave. But there have been times, and you'll hear word on the street, all the trout are starting to come through. So you can start at the south end of the land cut, and you can get a trout bite up until the point that they have progressed to, but they haven't, they're coming to Baffin, but they're not all the way there yet. Well, then the brown tide will come in, and those trout will hit that wall of brown water, and they won't go any further north. I mean, they do not like it. They stall, they turn around, and those fish never come through. So that's, amongst the fishermen, that's something we talk about a lot during the brown tide. So, I don't think these fish are in the cut now, but are they going to come through to start trying to replenish some of the fish out of Baffin, or is the brown tide going to stop them? So those are some of the, side effects of the brown tide that we have concerns about as fishermen.
How did it impact your guiding business?
I had to make a lot of excuses for tough days. People still came because there's still a chance. At that time, there were still a lot of big fish in the bay, so you still had a good chance of catching a trophy. Numbers fishing was pretty dang tough. So monetarily, it probably didn't affect my guiding business a whole lot. But results at the end of the day, it impacted it a lot. You just weren't getting the action, and you'll get clients with get bored, and you're just like, oh God, this is tough. And I'm like, all you can do is keep casting, But, like I said, monetarily, not so much, but, fish landed, fishing opportunities to, see your trophy fish and actually have the chance to catch one, it diminished those chances greatly.
Yeah. So that makes sense why you would get involved in the water monitoring.
Exactly.
So can you walk me through what that was like, and how often you did it and that sort of thing?
It seems like we were doing it every couple weeks. And there were many volunteers like myself, and some of them on the other side of the fence than me. I mean, there were guys that were throwing croaker that were concerned too. And some of those guys even got involved because, bottom line is they're making a living off of it now. And, they want a good fishery too, or as good as possible. And, sorry, I lost my train of thought.
People involved in the...
I'm sorry, can you re-ask the question again? That phone threw me off.
No worries. Can you kind of walk me through the process of the work you all did?
Okay. It was like a every 2 week deal, and you would volunteer your time, and there were set locations out in the bay where they would do very specific water samples from. They would do them at different depths in that same location every time, just so they could have a line, I guess, to base it off of high and low. If it's, and I remember they had a black and white disc, like cut into pies, quartered up, and you would drop that down and you could see how far the water clarity went down. The rope was numbered, so that was kind of one of their tests they did. And they would take these different samples, and I believe there was a mud sample taken off the bottom each time. And then they would gather the samples. I would, at that point, you know, I just had to get them out there and get them in safely. They would have a, they had a lab set up originally in the back of Baffin in the Loyola Beach area. And they would do their samplings and, you know, take their notes and do all that back there. And I believe it was eventually moved to a lab at Texas A&M here in Corpus.
Mm-hmm. What kept you, so how long did you do this?
That's a good question. I can't remember, you know, maybe a couple years, mm-hmm. or maybe not quite that long, a year and a half or so, I think is how long the whole study took.
Mm-hmm. What kept you, like, going out again and again and spending all of this time to bring these samples out and that sort of thing?
What kept me personally doing it? Oh, my love for the bay. I mean, is that the type of answer you're looking for? I mean, I was passionate about it. I mean, the bay is, it's my life, you know. It's what I'm passionate about. It's how I ended up here, you know. It's just, I mean, it is who I am. It, quoting some girl movie, it defines me. But I mean, that's what I'm, I mean, that's just it, that anybody that knows me knows I'm a man of that bay. You know, that's my number one passion, outside of my family. I've spent my whole 20s and now 52 years old, you know, I've spent my whole life just being there and, you know, I just want it to be healthy. I want it to be full of giant fish again. And anything I can do, as little as it is, as one guy, you know, I want to, if I can participate and lend a hand, you know, I want to do it.
Mm-hmm. And what did you hope you would learn, or what did you hope to see out of the work?
I wanted to know the root cause of it. I mean, I always had my theories what it was. And, but I wanted scientific fact, because there were some studies done on it that, you know, and I'm not a scientist, but I got a lot of common sense, and I just didn't make sense to me. And I really want to say something, but, you know, so, like I said, late 80s were the first brown tides. A lot of the ranches around the area got into, you know, they went from just being wild ranches, you know, without very little agriculture. And then they started going to the agriculture side, growing cotton, growing like commercial grass, you know, Bermudas and St. Augustine's and that kind of thing. And that all started in the 80s also. And then... you know, I know there was one study, I can't remember where it was from, that, you know, there were along the, there's two creeks that feed Baffin, very small tributaries. One's the Petronilla Creek and the other one is the Olmus Creek. And, the Petronilla Creek specifically runs right through the heart of South Texas agriculture. It just cuts right through it. And when all that started, you know, it was at that time, you know, the late 80s, early 90s is when those blooms took off. You know, it just kind of went along with when all the agriculture really got going, where they, you know, all of a sudden there was 50, 60,000 acres in commercial grass fields that obviously have to be fertilized and, you know, got to be watered. The water runs off with all the water, you know, it only can go, it either goes in the ground or runs to Petronilla Creek. You know, there's no buffers for it or anything like that at the time. I think there are now. And because the bay's been in pretty good shape for a while. So I'm hoping, you know, the work that Mike and everybody's done has a big part of that. But, you know, I just wanted the proof that that's what it was. And, you know, everybody say, no, it's a natural occurrence. And I'm like, this is not a natural occurrence. This is not from fish dying, laying on the bottom of the bay. And, you know, then studies started coming out. Other places like in Florida and some of the Carolinas that had never had brown tide all of a sudden started getting it. What did they have in common? Well, these areas along these bays all of a sudden went to like residential development and people, and they fully admitted it over there. You know, they're like, you know, all the fertilizers, nutrients, phosphorus, and all that, you know, is leaching into the bay. And they clearly state what it is, but I love Texas as much as any human being, but Texas was, in my opinion, very slow to admit what the problem was. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted something to be done about it. I mean, I'm all for commerce and people making a living and farming. I mean, part of my Louisiana family's farmers, and my mother's side, they're all farmers. I get it. I want everybody to be successful, but not at the loss of, you know, this special place that we have down here.
Yeah. So. Thank you. So what do you think success looks like in terms of current efforts to restore the bay?
You know, I'm optimistic. You know, the things I'm reading that, you know, some of the farming they're putting in these buffer zones and putting up, you know, natural blockers like native grasses and that sort of thing to keep the runoff from getting into the creeks. And I don't know if that's mandatory now or if it's just the ranches realizing, or the farmers, ranches, whatever you want to call them, realizing that, you know, maybe they're contributing to this and are taking the steps themselves, being proactive, you know. Because, you know, I mean, one of my best friends is a farmer. I mean, he loves to fish. He wants everything healthy, too, you know. So, and, you know, this fishing thing, it's a passion for me and a lot of other people. But, you know, it's a huge economic boost to this area. I mean, way more than the aquarium or the Lexington or anything like that. Not knocking them, but just making an analogy. I mean, people are buying these $100,000 boats, staying in hotels, eating at restaurants, buying thousands of dollars worth of lures, hiring guides, buying Sims waders. You know, it is a huge economic boost to this area. So if you've got an unhealthy, dying bay system, people aren't going to come. You know, they're not going to support all these industries. So it's even, you can play that angle, you know. You know, it's just such a big part of our lives down here. You know, it's just better for everybody if we've got a healthy bay. It's just better all the way around. So I think farmers and ranchers are starting to do the right thing. And again, I don't know if they're forced to do it or on their own, but whatever the end result is on that one, you know, whatever they can do to hold the fertilizers and everything back, you know, it's going to make a big difference.
Yeah. This is the question for I would consider you not an older generation, but this was one of the questions that Mike and I came up with. So how can we get younger generations to want to be stewards of Baffin Bay?
Have a healthy fishery. The more fish they catch, the more addicted they get to it. I think, and once they fall in love with it because they're having a lot of success, they become like me, because I didn't start out the guy that I am. I used to kill fish, but I realized there was a problem and I changed. You know, people to this day call me a hypocrite. They say, well, I remember when you used to bring in a lot of fish. I said, yeah, I made a mistake. I said, those were different times. We could bring in fish now. But I think, you know, a healthy fishery, a lot of fish, which, you know, all this is tied together because the fish need the habitat. Brown tide kills the habitat. You know, it's just an endless circle. But as long as you got a healthy fishery and people are down there having a good time, the more time they're going to want to spend down there. And and I think that's how you get more people involved. And, you know, I take a lot of fathers out mostly that will have a son or a daughter. And I have a lot. And, you know, it's really neat to watch these kids, you know, they'll catch fish and I'm like, man, that's a great one. Let's get a picture of it. You know, and he's like, yeah, let's do it fast. You know, I want to let it go. You know, these kids are already learning, you know, they're hearing things, reading things, and, you know, or maybe their father told them, because I'll tell their fathers, hey, we're not keeping any trout. You know, you keep a couple redfish for dinner, but that's it. So maybe they're relaying the message beforehand. But you can really see the change. You can see people going more to the conservation side now, which just thrills me to death. But But I think that's how you get the younger generation. The healthier the bay is, the more fish they're going to catch, the more they're going to come back. And once they build that love for it, they're going to naturally do like I evolved into. You know, they're going to fall in love with the bay and want what's best for it.
Mm-hmm. So those were the main questions that I had, but can you tell me some fish stories?
Give me a subject.
Big trout. Big Bath and Bay trout.
Big Bath and Bay trout. I have hundreds of them. I'll tell you some of my... one of my favorite stories doesn't even involve me. It involves a very close friend of mine. I told this on a podcast a while back. And when I was fishing tournaments towards the end of my tournament career, a fellow named Mark Holt was my fishing partner. And I'm 52, so Mark's probably about 10 years older than me, maybe 12. And he's just a fanatical fisherman. And he's from up around the Houston-Galveston area. And he's got a cabin in Baffin. And there's the Alazan Bay, which is an offshoot of Baffin Bay. Mark caught a really big trout back there one day. And he'd never mounted a fish, although he's caught huge fish for many, many years. And this fish came up. And this fish was so big, he's like, God, I'm going to mount this fish. I'm finally going to mount one. And he tells the stories. He pulled her up. She kind of rolled on her side. And he's like, her eyes like a half a dollar. She's so big, you know. And he said, I instantly knew that I couldn't kill this fish, you know. He said, but I didn't have anybody with me. And I wanted a picture of it. So he fills some water up in an ice chest. No ice, just, you know. Puts the fish in there, takes off, and Mark drives a little bitty boat with a small gas tank, so all this running is a big deal. Drives back towards the mouth of the bay, nobody's on the water, but he finds a commercial drummer, you know, drum fishing, idles over to him, asks the guy if he'd mind taking a picture of this big fish. He wants to let it go. And the drum guy does, takes a picture, and Mark throws it back in the ice chest, and the commercial fisherman said, I thought you were going to let it go. He said, I am. He said, but I'm going to take it back to where I caught it, which is like 17 miles away, you know, in his boat. So there's a good chance he's going to run out of gas doing all this. But it was such a big deal that to him to release her exactly in her home, you know, where he caught her. So that's just one of many cool stories stories that I think are cool. You know, I can, and I'm just freelancing here, but I can remember when a topwater lure called a skitterwalk came out. It was brand new, and I was in the area called the Badlands one day, and my boat had been parked. I'd been in the water for probably 5 or 6 hours, you know, in waders. So probably getting to the point where I need to get back on the boat to take care of business. And I'm throwing this topwater, and all of a sudden I get this big explosion on it, and I miss it, and it comes back and hits it again, and I finally catch it, and it's a redfish. Let it go, throw back out there, and then I can see multiple redfish going after this lure. So I'm just kind of toying with them, because redfish just aren't the trophy that a trout is. And I'm just kind of toying with them and tut-tut-tut-tut, working the lure, and boy, it just gets smoked by one of them. And I'm thinking, and I'm just horsing it in so I can get it off, you know, to catch another one. And I bring it in, and there's a giant trout mixed with them, you know, the longest trout I'd ever caught. You know, it was like, it wasn't quite 33 inches, but it was over 32 and a half. I mean, it was a really huge, huge fish. It was, you know, is one of the fish that I've caught over 10 pounds. And so the 10-pound fish I mentioned is kind of like the holy grail to the saltwater trout guy. So I've caught six over 10 and one over 11, but it's taken me 30-something years to do that. I mean, that's how rare they are. And that's not just 30-something years. That is, on the very conservative side, 200-plus days on the water a year. And that's on the very conservative side. It's probably, you know, closer to 250 to 275, you know. And, but, you know, catching certain fish during tournaments, you know, when you really needed that anchor fish to put you over the top to win the tournament, you know, those are all very, very special memories, or the opposite of that, losing that anchor fish, you know, in a tournament. Funny story, I was on a flat one day fishing a tournament, and I was throwing this Texas-made lure that the state record was caught on. There's a bunch of them hanging right behind you called a corky. And I'll grab you one so you can play with it. That's a very famous lure that the state record fellow named Jim Wallace caught February 6, 1996 on that lure. But I was throwing it on the flats, and that thing's got this just awesome wobble under the water and just looks so lifelike. And I'm in this area where I know there's big fish. I mean, obviously, I'm there the first day of the tournament. I get this hit, and I'm fighting this big fish, and she comes out of the water, and I just see the lure fly out of her mouth, and I'm just disgusted. I'm just heartbroken, you know, and I bend over, and I'm only in about high knee-deep water, and I bend over going, oh, my God. And another fish was tailgating her and hit that lure after it hit the water. It almost rips the rod out of my hand, and it's just as big, if not bigger, and I lose it, too. So in one cast, I lose two different monster trout, and... you know, that gets in my head, and, you know, I'm never going to recover from that during a tournament. I had another day, you know, I was fishing by myself after I'd been appraising all day. I went down, and I was fishing at the mouth of Baffin on a spool island, and I was using a really big, long topwater lure with three big treble hooks on it, and I caught a big trout, and, you know, I'm excited about it. And I get her up to me, and I grab her by the back of the head gently to try to get the hooks out of her so I can let her go. And she starts flopping around. And I instinctively just went to grab her so she wouldn't get away. And I forgot about the hooks. And I pressed her to my chest. And now the topwater's in the fish, in my shirt. And, oh, one more, in my hand. I'm hooked up three ways. And I'm by myself. So I've got an 8-pound plus trout hooked to me, you know, and I'm baffled, you know. I was like, what am I going to do? And I got my rod in my hand, and fish is trying to wiggle, and, you know, every time she wiggles, the hook goes deeper, and I'm in pain. And so I nothing else to do but walk to the island and get on my hands and knees. And, you know, I've got some hemostats I keep on my side, and I literally start cutting my shirt off, you know, getting that one free. And then I'm trying to get the fish unhooked because it looks like it's the easiest one to get undone so I can then go to my hand. And as I'm doing that, it's not working out easy. She starts flopping, and then she just, I mean, the first hook was already deep. Then she got another hook in me on the same hook. So, but long story short, I eventually get her unhooked and release her back into the water. I cut a big donut around my shirt, so I'm still hooked up, but now I'm free of everything. The hooks are out of the shirt. The fish is gone, but I got to get back on the boat and head to town and go to the emergency room to get hooks cut out of me. So, you know, all kinds of crazy stories like that. And, I mean, all kinds of great catching stories. I mean, I've just been so blessed to land so many beautiful, big, big fish down there, and I could literally sit here and dang near tell you every one of them. But I have a really good memory for fishing, not much else. But, you know, finding a special group of fish during the summer tournament where big trout are really hard to catch. And I learned something that I had never put together before. I was leaving an area pre-fishing for this tournament. And as I'm using my trolling motor to get out of back into the bay away from the rock pile so I can get my boat on plane, I see what I think is a school of big redfish. I'm like, oh, we'll have a little fun real quick. And I kind of troll over to them and throw into them, and I get a hit first cast. I'm like, oh, this is too easy, and bring it in, and it's like a 7-pound trout. Well, I proceed to catch 5 or 6 more of them like that. And they were just out in the middle of nowhere, but what the trout were doing, this was a great lesson for me. The trout were letting the school of drum go through. The drum make all the noise and are picking at the bottom. So all the bait fish on the outside edges are moving away from the drum, and the trout sit on the outside edges. So they're letting the drum spook them, and they're picking them off. And that's how I was catching them. Well, the tournament was a week later, and it was deep water, so I was having to fish out of the boat, which I never do. But I ended up winning this really big tournament, and that was what I did all day, was just I got out there and followed schools of drum around, fishing the edges of them, you know, and everybody else was wading in the hot summer. It was an August tournament, you know. Nobody was catching anything, but I was out there just catching these monster trout in the middle of the summer, which is kind of unheard of, but just doing something very unorthodox like fishing a school of drum. So things like that are all great memories for me.
Yeah.
So.
Thanks. Well, do you have anything to add about Bath and Bay?
You know, not much more than I said, I don't think, but just, you know, I would just ask everybody to be respectful of her, you know, treat her like a lady, and, you know, just love and cherish her, and, you know, run your boats properly. Don't tear things up, meaning the shorelines and the grass beds, and don't run in shallow water and, you know, prop chop fish. Not that you're trying to kill fish, but it happens when you're doing that. You know, and just have a conservative mindset. Don't be greedy. Leave some for the next guy or for you to catch again. You know, if you want a future down there and you want to see big fish again, everybody's got to be proactive and responsible and a good steward of the bay. I mean, it's really kind of that simple. It's, you know, I don't mean to pick on younger generations because I use social media too, but, you know, a lot of our problems nowadays seem to be people wanting the, what we call glory shots, you know, with these big stringers of fish. What's the point? I mean, check your ego at the door, take a picture of it alive, let them go. And, but that's kind of the new thing now is social media. I think it's being pretty detrimental to the bay. I probably should have brought that up earlier, but it just occurred to me to say it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Like I just said a while ago, Jimmy Buffett song, I can't remember which one, Treat Her Like a Lady. He's talking about a bay in that song. It's just one of his sailing songs, Treat Her Like a Lady. So I guess that's it.
Okay. Well, that's a good place to stop then. Thank
All
you.
All right. Great.